Hey, I'm Terry Foy.
And I'm Nick Osello. Welcome to the tailgate.
Thank you for coming back to the Tailgate Podcast. I want to know, will you be my girl? The Princeton Tigers are the 2026 national champions. I am Terry Foy, joined by Larkin Kemp. Nick Osello, where is he, Larkin?
Nowhere to be found. Tough look for him. Claims to be moving houses. I don't really know what that means. His alma mater takes it on the chin, but all class from Kevin Corrigan. And oh, here he is.
Oh no.
Little does he know that we're already
recording. We literally just started.
No. Not for me. Not for me. We're live. Coming at you live now.
Congratulations. Are you in a new home, Nicholas?
No, I'm in an old home right now. An old rental, and we upgraded to buying our first house together. And if the boomers taught me anything, pull up the ladder as soon as you acquire property. Only people who own homes should be able to vote in this country, Terry Foy.
It says a lot to be taken on a home mortgage like 18 months before a rate cut session. Good work. Always well timed out of you.
Talk to me about your portfolio, Larkin. What do you got? You're sitting in a 300-square-foot apartment in Manhattan? That's cool.
Any comment 2 years later on the Pat McAfee quote from Pat Kavanaugh? Any comment that NIL
guys, great,
is actually
great to be
induced
joining.
A wagon
hey,
of an Ivy
Terry,
League.
Terry, this is your podcast. Larkin's a guest. Maybe he should remember that. Terry, how are you?
I'm great, Nick. How are you, buddy? Anything happened today
Feeling
aside
wonderful.
From moving homes?
I mean, yeah, everyone's going to gang up on the skinny, hot homeowner now just because it's jealousy. But the more I reflect on it, the more it's like the ultimate tip of the cap. I can't remember a more dominant performance offensively in particular. We can get to the defense in a second. I thought Princeton was a good unit when they played together. I did not know that they could go junkyard dog, bully ball with individual performances to the extent that they did. And were it not for it being my alma mater, that would have been one of the most enjoyable offensive performances I have ever seen in my life. The depth, the individual assassins that they have, how they're completely selfless when they want to be, and how when they turned on a selfish aspect, everything worked. And I'm pissed about it. So I don't know. A lot of conflating emotions right now.
Let's get back to the rundown. Larkin, number one, big picture thoughts. What do you think?
I took a long walk to digest. Like, ultimately, it's always hard for me when a league rival raises a championship trophy, but
tough 2 years for you.
You want to take the glass half full view of Princeton is an incredibly hard place to be a student athlete. For those who don't understand, they have grade deflation. They have no academic support services to allow you to hide from things like thesis papers and tests and problem sets. Like, for Matt Madelon to inherit the job the way he did, for him to build out his staff with quality pieces like Mitchell and Hirsch, for him to turn Princeton into a fun, cool place to go play, like, they recruit at an extremely high level. That offensive performance, and really all year, like, if you've been listening to this podcast, every time I'm here, I sing the praises of, if an alien landed and we had to show them what, like, fluid offense is supposed to look like, you could really show them any possession of 26 Princeton. Like, they are, it's beautiful. They attack from all places. Their second line midfield, you know, is head down dominant in the sense that they have confidence and conviction in what they can bring. Anytime, like, Notre Dame has the best athlete cover poll in years, right? Not just this year, but maybe decades, in the sense of, like, erasing. And no problem. Kabiri doesn't need to dodge when lights on ball. Like, we got six dudes out here who can run by people and generate leverage. So I think it's encouraging in the sense that I because of my personal biases, was very nervous about the direction college sports was heading with NIL, with you know, this variance between like revenue generating sports and football and basketball, and does that mean there's enough money for the smaller sports? And for Cornell and Princeton to go back to back in the face of that headwind, when they can't pay ball carriers and they can't give out scholarships, and you know, I'm sure we're going to get to the quote about what Penn State offered the Adelphi Mitty, but really it's just, it's like a great day for college athletics. You know, I'm not sure I've ever seen a bigger party than what was going on in that Princeton student fan base and all the alumni and the 2001 team there. So I'm happy for Mr. Madelon. I'm happy for the kids. And now it's back to work because, you know, I want them at the bottom of the table and us at the top. So the flowers end there, but we can win a national championship at Brown. That's a fact. Just happened twice.
Yeah, it's definitely about Brown.
Opinion.
Yeah. But you did set me up perfectly by talking about the party in the class of 2001, because I did make my way over to the Princeton tailgate before it started, and I just want to give a couple shout-outs. First to my boy Tom Barnes, who one of my favorite people in lacrosse, but also got an opportunity to say hello to Matt Strebel and Ryan Boyle, who were really influential on kind of my early days at Inside Lacrosse. But it was a conversation that I had with John Hess that I want to kind of tip a cap to, because the thing that stands out about the Princeton alumni support relative to some of the other alumni supporters groups is the combination of, and I will concede that Bill Tierney leaving of his own volition relative to, say, at Navy where Richie Mead was let go, or Johns Hopkins with Dave Petromala, it's a different set, right, of circumstances. But, you know, certainly when Chris Bates got the job, you know, there weren't loud detractors. And then the search around replacing Bates after the incident with Larkin's friend John Yazzo Scaparata, an event that we've already talked about, I believe, this year on this podcast, the search was characterized as being an indication of how appealing the job was. But John's comment was, the players wanted Matt Madelon to get the job, and everybody else was like, all right, cool, that sounds good, great, go run with it. You pointed out what I think is the most important job of any head coach, which is hiring and developing and managing great assistants, empowering and delegating to them the opportunity to do their thing. And I think that those two guys have developed identities at each end of the field that are as firm and disparate and appropriate for what they're asking their groups to do as any. And we talked a lot about Jim Mitchell's principles-based offense and how free-flowing it is, how their ability to be unselfish, attack from all angles, everybody eats. We haven't given enough credit to the absolute savages that they have at the other end of the field, and I don't think that it's limited to this year. I've talked about this before, but the fact that over the course of the 2022 season, when they made a Final Four run, a different long pole had the best game of the day. Five different long poles over the course of the season. I can't recall that ever happening in the history of college lacrosse with another team. And you look at, you know, the intervening time, Bo Pettersson stands out as just, you know, kind of top of the list of an incredible athlete and, you know, a level of physicality that is so dichotomous to the offensive beauty. And this year was a good example of that. And we're going to talk about the strategic and tactical shift to go zone. But I also just want to make sure that we shout out what Casey Dowd has done with Andrew McMeekin in terms of, you know, I think the thing that is probably the best endorsement is he got better as the year went on, right? Didn't get off to the best start relative to certainly expectations. He got better as the weekend went along. His Monday was better than his Saturday. And on Monday, he got better as the day went along. You know, at one point he was 9 for 20. He went to, I guess that would be, I think he won his next four faceoffs after that. So that is a tip to Casey in terms of working with the faceoff unit. You know, obviously they had another guy coming off the bench and you know, win a few draws as well, which is another endorsement of a quality job. But then back to Matt, this has been a group that has consistently had great goaltending, and it's now spanned three or four different goaltenders, you know, just since COVID. So there was a lot of reflection on the 2021 team that had their season taken from them, and certainly, you know, the 2020 team that got off to the undefeated start with Michael Sowers as setting the foundation. George Bond was given a lot of credit for the work that he did, but I think that the alumni deserve you know, measure of respect as well for their role in this, in terms of letting this organization be an organization and letting these guys develop as they did. So a lesson for all the other folks out there that want to see their programs do the same thing. All right, Nick, Notre Dame got out to a 3-0 lead. How are you feeling then?
I was feeling really good. We had just unloaded the heavy items.
Well timed.
So I'd missed the first two goals. We arrived at the bar, and I saw the third, and I thought we were rolling. I thought this is what I was waiting for three quarters against Syracuse for. You know, I think in the last episode we talked about, I'm very curious to see how both teams who have deep and good success with every end of the field, what is the tactical advantage that is going to emerge? And at the beginning, it was, if you're a Notre Dame fan, I think it was exactly what you were looking for. We have the best athletes on the field, and a lot of them are playing midfield on the offensive side. That first step, watching Jeffries, watching Maharis, watching Yago, it seemed like it was a snowball that could have gotten out of hand. And, you know, we'll talk about the adjustments first, but that's what I had been wanting to see out of Notre Dame's offense all year. It seemed like the spark of the fourth quarter of Syracuse and the first three goals of today were kind of that final, you know, until it quickly became a panicked inhale, an exhale of relief of saying, this is what the offense has always supposed. This is what they were supposed to be. This is who they are supposed to look like. And, you know, I think that there are facets that we can take from certainly the second half of the season, but even how this game got out. You know, nobody's going to look at this game in a positive light over the summer. But I think that if there are some mature juniors, you can say, hey, this is how we can play. Like, we were up 3-0 in the national championship, and we can certainly work on our zone offense. But let's not forget what we have, which is an offense and a system that can throw pretty big haymakers, not just in the fourth quarter of games to close them out, but to start the game so that we're not hitting the panic button all season. That's, I don't know. All of it sounds stupid knowing the outcome of the game, but like that was my honest take in real time.
I think that's fair. And I think that something Chris Wojcik will perhaps kick himself on is not going back to Jeffrey early. Like, his first step, I don't know if any, you know, if we recall in live, you know, live format, his like first left to right, back to lefty roll, and then he missed the cage over the top. It was electric. And I was screaming like adjustment, and they ultimately made one, obviously. And I'm sure we're going to talk about the zone, you know, for a long time. But I think, put differently, this Notre Dame offense outperformed me all year. Like, they got a lot out of this group. I think the only player that they're going to wish they could have found a way to spark in terms of just like point contribution, I think there's a world where Matt Jeffrey 2 years from now is like 120 points, right? And we're going to be looking back thinking, how could we not get him the rock more consistently on the low wing to just force teams to move? But yeah, they did everything they need to. They started hot, right? We've talked at, you know, often about whoever plays second on Saturday and like how tough it is to get off to that strong start and settle in. And listen, they punched hard early. Like, they looked the part, they looked athletic. Defensively, they were stick down, you know, sitting in their chair and grinding with Chunk. So I think this is a story, and I think Corrigan deep down feels this way. Like, he got a lot out of this room, and they were very much there on Monday. This is just a very special Princeton offense, and they deserve their flowers. That's really the story for me.
Well, let's talk about the zone adjustment now. So, talking to Jeremy Hirsch after, he said that they had already planned to switch it up. His comment was, you know, it was out of respect for Woj and the Notre Dame offensive game plan. He was just like, even if the man-to-man was working, I didn't want them to get comfortable with the same thing. And Madeline said that the plan was to zone the second line, which is a good, relatively easy way to create and switch up variability. Larkin, was there anything that you saw in particular about the zone look? And what do you think is, what are the principles of zone offense as you think about it?
So I think my top-down funnel of like decision-making of how to zone is how athletic are the two and three middies that'll be dodging the short sticks, right? Can they hold up, right? That's top of the funnel. So this is back when you're deciding like, how are we going to defend this team? The second bullet, which is critical, is do they consistently play zone? And what I mean by that is Notre Dame's defense doesn't zone. They don't practice zone. They have the proudest
incredibly well
culture in the country, okay? This is very different than zoning BU's offense, who practice against it all the time, right? And then the third is how are our sticks? Because there's going to be very consistent 3v2 push-pull and no different than who plays man down. Like, ultimately, you are getting into long string rotations and you have to run the baseline if the pipes have to slide up, which Notre Dame calls an axe. We call something different. But in terms of like, what do I see? The way you think about a zone is first you look at the pipes, right? It's who have they put inside? Is it a short stick or a pull? Are the pipes actually playing man? So when a low man engages, does the backside pipe flip, right? And does the cover defenseman actually go through X with him? That's like probably the second level. And then the third is where do they put the pulls? So like, where are they hiding the shorties basically, right? Is one inside, one at the top, or are they doing pulls different places? I think what I saw with Princeton zone, it was fairly low activity. So they're not generating rotates. They're making Notre Dame earn them, which is, I think, a critical point. And they're high IQ. They do a good job of filling in space, and they clearly look like they've been practicing it, even though they haven't needed to show it much, which is a huge credit to Hirsch. And I also want to credit Madelon. Like, especially when your plan A is as good as it is, like, they're a great team. They were number one preseason or most of the year, right? But for it to look as fluid as it does, and, you know, for the generals on the back end, the high IQ guys, often not the cover ones, by the way. The elite zone players are very frequently the guys who get picked on in man. So, like, those guys yep. deserve a ton of credit. And, yeah, I think in terms of, like, Notre Dame and how an offense needs to break down a zone is if you split the field down the middle, so if you laid train tracks, okay, it's 3v2 push-pulls in both alleys, they got to get the first guy to rotate, right? So everything needs to be designed to create crash follow lanes and basically like high-low picks, where a low pipe defender needs to make a decision of vacating the best player on the team, right? Josh Iago, who's behind the cage, and sliding up to like the third or fourth middy to stop a 3v2 push pull top down, right? So what you don't want to do is a Matt Jeffrey type who is so comfortable operating in space. Like, he's a football wide receiver. He's so free flowing. When he gets downhill, he's running at you like a, you know, Ford pickup truck. Where he's not as comfortable as like on his heels, looking this way, looking the other direction, and like running basically like pump fake offense. So, you know, Chris Wojcik is a very elite man up coordinator. And often those are good, you know, good coordinators to coach man zone offense, because it's very similar principles.
For sure.
Righty lefty wheels. It's through balls. It's get the ball through X and push the backside with a seal slip. Like, I know he can coach this offense. I had to defend his version of it. I think it's often, do you have the personnel and the pieces? And sometimes your best man pieces are not your best zone pieces. And it's very hard as a coaching staff to say, hey, I'm now going to play this third line middie who hasn't contributed all year in the national championship because I think he's better at zone, right? Very few teams are going to do that. So yeah, I think it's just a really good lesson, frankly, for people who, you know, are maybe more casual listeners. One of the coolest parts about lacrosse is like, you can actually make adjustments, right? When a team has a dominant ball carrier, like, you can do different things in how you slide and how you fill and in particular, actually getting out of Man D that like dramatically, you know, make a difference in the way the offense has to play. No different than when you turn on like a Rick Pitino college basketball team and they're playing high pressure 3-2 zone. Like, it's different. It looks different. It is different. And I give a lot of credit for Princeton for developing their kind of, you know, plan B and for having it ready. And, you know, for any high school coach or whatever listening, that's why you need it. Like, you need it when you're getting overhand righted 3-0, you know, as the one seed in the national championship and what will be viewed as one of the best timeouts in the history of the game.
It's a perfect point because 3-0 to an 11-goal run. Like, it looked like Princeton was not going to be able to compete, and then it turned into Notre Dame is not able to compete. And what it speaks to is not the merit of the tactics. It speaks to the fact that the appearance of the talent is not an assurance of how the game is going to go. And it's another point for why we love sports, because they are the meritocracy where ingenuity can sometimes overcome brute force. And to me, the thing that was so interesting, so first of all, this Notre Dame team, despite your compliment for Woj's man-up prowess, was not a great man-up team, and it was something that garnered a lot of attention because they scored 5 man-up goals against Syracuse on Saturday, and Josh Yago did a great job of orchestrating from top center, but also moving around because his shots did not come from top center, right? That was kind of where he was in more of a facilitator role. What was so interesting to me, because when you consider the important component parts for good zone offense, I think most people would point to ball movement and stretch shooting, largely because those are the things that we associate with good zone offense in basketball. May or may not be true in lacrosse, but if it is true, Notre Dame should be good at those things because we've seen them be good at those things in their man offense. Your point about not practicing against it is an exactly right one. I think the righty-lefty balance comment is really interesting as well, especially because even though we did see Brady Picorni on Saturday a little bit, when they went to him in the second quarter, it felt like a lever pull. Like, is this going to work? And I think he's the example of the third-line middie, even though he's a backup attackman that we can talk about here. But what was interesting was that it was a one-to-one replacement for Luke Miller, and I don't know if it only lasted one possession, but I only noticed it for one, and then Miller came straight back on. What I saw was a lack of six-man cohesion around when do we want to go? Effectively, what tempo do we want to play at offensively? And I think that there were two issues that compounded that. The first was the overall kind of lack of everybody understanding the zone offense plan, but that complicated by the lead, right? Like, It was like, do we protect this 3-goal lead for 50 minutes, you know, 40, 55 minutes? Like, what are we doing here? Like, I think that it was hard for that to permeate everybody. And then the second was, what's the hierarchy of who we want to go and from where do we want him to go? It felt like so many times I saw Dylan Faison or Matt Jeffrey dodge seams from top right and top left. And they did it very 50%, very half-heartedly. And it's one thing if you're testing the seam and trying to half dodge, because that's what you're talking about. Like, the one of the things about playing good zone offense relative to playing good man offense, like, you know, we talked about this a lot among our staff on Saturday, is the downside of beating somebody so clean with enough time for the defense to recover. And I thought that was another thing that made it difficult for Notre Dame to really adjust, because their first several offensive possessions were not just good in terms of creating high quality goal scoring chances. They were good in terms of, like, this is the game plan working. They did such a good job of not just isolating the short stick to dodge onto because Princeton decided that they weren't going to pull Jeffrey, which, you know, in and of itself was a bold choice. But then Notre Dame did a great job of putting, if it was Jackson Green guarding him, putting Cooper Mueller into the slide position, right? And that's what happened when he dodged from X and they got the goal out of that. Because it was like, oh man, like, they really have Princeton's defense on the strings here, right? They're puppet mastering this whole thing. And so when it went the other way, it was like the Notre Dame offense was like, but what about the other thing? We were doing so good good with that. Like, go back to that. Let us attack that again. And I guess the point is, Princeton is so good at beating guys by a half step as opposed to beating guys by two steps. And what that does is it puts defenses in the position of, do we support this or do we not support this? Right? There was a Colin Burns goal off where he just cut perfect front side crease. He was standing on the front side of the crease. He cut to the backside along the arc of the goal, perfectly timed with a dodge from X. And Will Gallagher was guarding him at the time, and he got caught in the wash. Just was a little bit ball watchy, looked at the wrong time. And it was a great example of, do I go or do I not go, right? Because since there was no clean go decision, there was no obvious second slide, and that was why you have the best finisher on the team wide open on the crease. What Notre Dame seemed to struggle with was, who do we want to start from where? And then what they defaulted to were guys who were effectively the most effective dodgers against man defense, and it didn't adjust to the half dodging that you needed, and it just manifested in kind of half-hearted dodging. Nick, your thoughts?
Well, to me, it was more about, and I know everybody is going to dog on, oh, Notre Dame had 2 years to, you know, prepare for the zone defense, kind of flashbacks to our Penn State elimination game 2 years ago.
That was last year.
Last year?
Yeah, you won 2 years ago, and then you won 3 years
ago. 2 years ago. Yeah, sorry, last year. But the interesting thing to me was for Princeton to not be identified as a zone defense, they showed a true understanding of a six-man zone defensive unit. And I was even reflecting on my time when we would have our zone buster offense, and it was perfect. We had Perkovic from outside. You know, we had guys that could finish inside. So anytime the offense was in zone, we had some of those half steps, and you know, we had some of those principles where a lot of people were comfortable backpedaling and throwing a pass adjacent. And Princeton's zone defense applying that much pressure to simple adjacent passes, where you really made the ball carrier decide, well, I kind of have a path to the goal if I commit 100%, but I need to go all out. But he's also kind of in the passing lane of the easiest pass on the field, the simple adjacent pass. Like, the adjacent approaches from Princeton's zone defense was a masterclass. And then combine that with almost a reverse situation where the offense or the defensive adjustments that Notre Dame made coming out of halftime, saying, you know, they just went on their run. They are showing that they can dodge through a lot of our one-on-one. And that it wasn't even bad defense. It was just, they have a lot of reps clearly with getting quality shots off with pressure on their hands, which is a skill that's learned over time. You don't naturally develop that. So credit to the Princeton offense for developing that skill with six players on the field at the time. Usually that's only something that you have to worry about one or two guys. And then when Notre Dame decided to be more slide heavy, the passes were just so perfect. The decisions were made with as close to 100% clip as I've ever seen of making the right decision in the right time. So, you know, I think it goes back to Larkin's point. I've clearly had a lot of time to think about this because I've just been moving and stewing on this game. But the zone defense and the zone offense that we were preparing for when I was coaching at Air Force, like, the zone defense guys, three of them were not the traditional starters. It was just the smart players that were able to develop elite level IQ. You know, one of the guys was kind of our man down specialist because he was the quarterback that could guide everything. We had one of those guys, and it seemed like Princeton had six of those guys. And that's something that starts probably before preseason. It was probably something that was being installed in fall ball. And, you know, from a player perspective, I got to imagine it was pretty cool to get really good as a zone defensive unit, knowing that that would be kind of your ace in the hole when you needed it. So by the time zone's being called out in that, and Larkin, I think you and I can discuss this, when we had Zebra for the Outlaws, which was our zone defense for the Outlaws, I hated that. I hated that because we didn't practice it enough. Well, I hated it because I didn't truly understand my role. Like, it was this weird, I'm playing low left, which is not where I want to be in the first place, and I don't know if I'm more of an adjacent disruptor or a guy who's trying to guard the backside of the crease. And it just seemed like there was never a moment on Princeton's zone defense where there was confusion on who was responsible for what. Not just the adjacent guys, but the backside guys. And Larkin, I'll pass it off to you for a second. But my biggest worry from this game is what the youth and the club lacrosse practices look like come tomorrow. This game is going to be
Virginia won a zone in won a national championship in 2011 playing zone, and the world was okay the next day. Let's calm down.
No, it's Terry. This is going to decimate Idaho. They're going to say we need to play Princeton style offense when three players on the team can pass and catch. So I got an uphill battle.
The other thing on zone, and we could spend 5 hours on it clearly, but I want to give Matt immense credit. Terry highlighted that the plan was against the second line midfield. For him to trust his eyes and go away from their prep sheet of, hey, maybe the plan was we're going to play it for a few minutes a quarter, which a lot of coaches do as like a plan B just to not allow offenses to get in rhythm, right? Or secondly, we're going to play it against very specific personnel. For him to trust his eyes out of that timeout and basically say, wait, this looks better than I anticipated against ND1s. And the zone buster, which is the term Nick just used, of what's the best way to get a team out of zone to beat it, right? Like, it never can. And for him to stick with it, is it takes immense courage, and it's why you have to tip the cap like to the coaching masterclass, because it's very, very hard for coaches to move away from their game plan. Like, they're detailed guys, they're type A, they're prepared, and that was not the plan. Like, they did not plan to go down 3-0, have to burn a timeout and fall back into a junk D, which is what it is, just so everyone understands, at the highest level of the sport, okay, and stick with it for the next however many minutes. It's great.
You know what made it easier, though? And Nick, the first 30 minutes of this podcast probably hasn't felt very good. This is going to hurt a lot more. The final ground ball differential was 46 to 30, plus 16 for Princeton, plus 14 in non-faceoff ground balls. But the worst number was actually the second worst number was first half non-faceoff ground balls, meaning take the faceoffs out, all the other ground balls that were you know, in normal run of play 50-50 action. Princeton 20, Notre Dame 3. And get this.
Three?
Princeton's attackmen combined for 11 ground balls. Non-faceoff ground balls, Notre Dame's 3 close defensemen combined for 5. Plus 8 for Princeton attackmen versus Notre Dame close defensemen in ground balls in their zone. How's that make you feel?
Shut up is how it makes me feel. Like, what do you want me to say here? Because that was, and I love my wife so much. Watching sports with her is just a blessing every single time we do it, especially when it's a natty. But, you know, she kind of asked me at half when I was pissing my pants in the bar. She's like, what does Notre Dame need to do to fix this? And I'm like, well, it's a combination of two things. One, every time the ball hits the deck, look at who gets the ball. And she's like, yeah, it's Princeton. And then the second is not all ground balls are created equal. And I would say this if the roles were reversed, and they have been reversed where Notre Dame has been the beneficiary of it in the past, is it just seemed like they're, you know, the loose balls, and when there was a little bit of confusion, whether it was off a pipe, whether it was a scrum and somebody kicks it and everybody's looking for the ball, it just seemed like every 50-50 break, it just so happened that the ball squeaked out to a Princeton player. You know, I think there was even a goal. Ball goes off the crossbar, kind of goes up in the air. Everybody's looking for it, and it winds up in the back of the Princeton player's stick.
Yep.
Like, I have never been able to quantify that as a player or as an analyst or whatever. You know, sometimes the ball just doesn't bounce your way. And what you have to do in those situations is win those actual 50-50s, and Notre Dame just never did. And I think it goes back to Princeton's offense being a more elite unit than I had thought, to where I'm putting them up with, you know, some of the generational and historical teams, because not just their ability to shoot with pressure on their hands, which kind of started the cascade and the avalanche you know, for that 11 goal run and the ultimate victory. But, you know, it's why it's really difficult to play against Canadians. Like when you have a team that's really good at handling pressure, that pressure doesn't just apply to how they exert their 6-on-6 offense against you. It also comes to play in ground balls, and it also comes to play in a number of other things. But to go back to answering your question, how does it make me feel? It makes me feel bad. Is that what you wanted to hear? Are you happy now, Terry?
Terry's on mute.
I mean, I can keep, you know, abusing myself here if that's what you guys want. If you think that's good podcast listening, just let me know. This sucks. I'm moving. I'm sweaty. Notre Dame got their ass kicked. This sucks. Today sucks. I have an early flight tomorrow, and nobody even cares. Larkin, shut up.
Larkin, ground balls. You're good at them. What do you think?
Used to be.
Yeah, dog on a bone, right? Like Notre Dame has a culture of elite rides clears and elite ground ball play, and they just got their butt kicked in that area by a team that's not known for that, right? So I think Anish called it out well early in that kind of groundswell. So before the run had moved from 3-4-5 to like 10, there was a helter skelter GB in the near side alley in the defensive end where Princeton Poles were like selling out, making really crafty hockey footy plays and coming up with rocks that they shouldn't have. And I think it just speaks to a team on a mission and like utter belief. And you know, it certainly was the difference today. I do agree with some of Nick's point that there seemed to be a little, you know, ball luck's probably the term. If this was a 7-game series home away, it wouldn't be a sweep. Notre Dame is really good, super athletic. But that was a huge difference. And the goalie play from both guys was really, really solid. And just the last point on the zone, you can't even consider junk if you don't trust your goalie. You can't. Hard fact. It is the top of the table. It's the foundation of the zone. It's, you know, no different than you don't build a house till you lay the concrete. Like, that is, without question, you're giving up bombs, and the percentage of possessions ending in shots are going up. But I also just, you know, to comment quickly, I thought Richie Iardelli was fantastic. So, certainly not a him problem, but we'll continue.
Well, and I thought that the zone also served another purpose, which was it helped Ryan Kraddick get settled. And, you know, he only made one save on allowing the first three goals, and then he made five in a row. You know, and it really slowed the game down in a lot of ways. But mostly it slowed the game down in terms of the length of the Notre Dame defensive possessions. And so, you know, as the shot clock gets lower, you can focus and be a little bit more confident that you're going to see a shot in the next however many minutes or seconds rather. And it turned out that he did. Next up on the agenda is a more abstract conversation about Princeton's offense. I feel like we've kind of checked that box, but the one element that we haven't really dove into is Chad Palumbo's role as the emotional leader of the team. And it's kind of embarrassing, in my opinion, that we've gotten this far and haven't talked about it, because the moment, I think it was still, I can't recall whether it was in the first quarter or the second quarter. Yeah, it was in the second quarter because Princeton was at the open end of the field, the lawn end of the field, the hill end of the field, when he got his helmet knocked off during the sequence when Madelon called timeout. And he picked up his helmet and he went to the sideline. I think at this point they were probably up 5-3 or 6-3. And he was really just getting the crowd juiced. Obviously his story is incredible, and they did a really nice job of showing a condensed version of his story, his fight against cancer during the broadcast. I've gotten to know him a little bit. He wants to go into broadcasting. He has an incredible and special charisma, but he's also a really, really unique lacrosse player in a lot of ways, and I think very much an emblem or a manifestation of what this Princeton offense has become. And on a week, and we'll get to this momentarily, when I think it's more likely than not that Nate Kibiri is going to win the Towarden Award, it's interesting that Chad Palumbo is going to be the guy that I remember from this run, and Ryan Kraddick is probably the guy that would have won it had you know, it not been limited to five finalists and instead been, call it, the 25 nominees from which the winner could have won. Larkin, your thoughts?
Yeah, I think that's all really well said. I think, like, at the end of the day, a special locker room, like, starts with the leadership group having their nose to the door and being guys that can motivate and galvanize. like ultimately college sports is about waking up early in tracksuits and grinding with your best friends and fighting like hell for a night like they're having right now and a week like they're about to have. And I think that not only this senior class, but, you know, to give Coulter Mackesy and that group and a lot of the alums credit, you know, it takes a village. It takes a village of swagger and belief. Like, it takes, you know, charisma is probably the right word, frankly. And, you know, when you're getting off the bus or when you're walking into a bar for a bar fight, which is what it is playing Notre Dame, like, it's put your big boy pants on and go to work. Like, there's nowhere to hide. And I think, you know, you said it very well. Like, leadership comes in different shapes and sizes, but leadership for Princeton this year meant putting your head down and beating the guy in front of you. All six guys on offense could do it. Every senior on the team could do it who had the ball on their stick. And that's very rare. Like, some of the best teams in the history of the sport, frankly, have been one or two guys and a lot of complementary pieces and elite goaltending, right? That's not really this Princeton team. Like, this Princeton team, you know, people looking down the bench saying, "Coach, put me in, I can do that," because they can. And that's pretty cool. And, you know, I think that people need to understand that Ryan Wellner and Notre Dame are hyper-prepared. It's one of the best coaches in the country. And, you know, I genuinely believe he woke up today thinking two or three Princeton guys could beat his dudes. Not six. Not eight. Like, I think he felt okay on the Palumbo matchup. I think he felt okay on every second-line midfield matchup. And that's not to not give credit, but that's because Notre Dame has elite athletes and they're really good. And, you know, there's two bullets in the scouting chart. It's like, who are we going to? Like, who needs help? And who do we feel pretty damn good on, right? And I'm just telling you, Notre Dame did not expect to have to slide to all six, which is what it felt like at times. It felt like a tidal wave. And it says a lot. It says a lot about the group. And you're right. There are certain years where the Toroton Ward should really be broken up and, like, given to a bunch of the fellas, right? Like, the Loyola team that won, you know, you think about Rat and Hawk, and you think about, like, Lusby and I think it was Sawyer. Like, there was just a lot of really good players on that team. And this group reminds me of that. Like, this is a team. Like, it is. So it's one of those where, like, if a guy rolled an ankle, I'm not even sure they'd skip a beat. And there's really no higher compliment you can pay. So ton of credit.
Go ahead, Nick. Well, great call out with the Loyola team, because I was trying to pin why I felt almost, again, it's going to sound very corny, but, like, appreciative that if my alma mater had to lose, it was against a team like this. Because that should be it should be how every coach thinks about their team. And whether that's through a youth or a high school lens, cause that's the game that I'm kind of rolling with right now, but it was just a perfect example of what happens when you develop everybody and you don't rely on your one or two studs. Like, when Palumbo gave that interview at halftime, I was like, okay, if we have to lose, I'm glad it's to a guy like this who's on a team like this, who's going to have any bar tab from the Princeton 2001 team covered tonight. Like, I was starting to cope so early in this game. And by the end of it, I had damn near convinced myself, where I'm like, this was kind of Princeton's destiny. Just with everything that's happened with the Ivies and COVID and the ramifications of it. And if this is their leader, it was a great tale of two, like, what was going to be the emerging storyline. Josh Yago winning it on Memorial Day, as he stood for attention, which was the coolest moment, you know, of the year for me, at least, given all the ties there. And I'm like, how could it get any better than this? Oh, and then Palumbo gives that halftime interview. And I'm like, son of a bitch. He may have pulled it off. He may have disrespected the troops enough to where people aren't mad that Josh Yago didn't get to cut the nets on Memorial Day.
Well, let's take it to happier times. So Josh Yago put up 7 points in Notre Dame's win over Syracuse in the second semifinal. we already touched on it, but it was a game that hinged on a Louis D'Agostino non-releasable penalty, during which Notre Dame scored three goals on extra man. I think I might have already said it, but Yago finished with seven. And Nick, you started by saying that this was the offense that you had been wanting to see all season, kind of implying that like you didn't feel great about what you saw against the Orange. Is that the right interpretation?
Yeah.
Why?
And it just seemed like the athletes on Notre Dame's offense realizing that they have the capability to play how they want to play. Because a lot of times, and I think the frustration was when we were attacking from the high wing in particular, but I think it was even more than that. A lot of the dodges weren't just, I'm better than you downhill, I'm going to shoot it. There seemed to be some consistency with our dodges are going from maybe the high wing or the mid wing up to top center. And then we're looking for that throwback. Or, you know, there were so many times where I'm like, guys, you're a better athlete. Get north and south and put the ball in the net. Like, you know, I think we might be trying to get too cute. I don't want to discredit our opponents. But it seemed like when we started to run the proverbial wing T in the fourth quarter against Syracuse, just saying, hey, our man up's doing good. But I think that man up, the 2-minute non-releasable, gave them the confidence to play for almost a full quarter what we had only seen in two or three possessions in a row all year. And it's what we saw at the beginning of the Princeton game until they switched it to zone and stifled the exact reason why that was working. So to me, like, and I know I mentioned it in the Princeton breakdown, like the fourth quarter of the Syracuse game gave me all the confidence in the world of our guys have finally clicked. They're comfortable and they know where their teammates are going to dodge. They're going to give the playmakers space in the space that they want it. And they're going to make those slide decisions tough. And I don't think we had seen that consistently for a full quarter. You know, maybe the UNC game. But yeah, that to me was, hey, we got a bit of a lead. We got the 2-minute non-releasable. Our man up is flying around and making plays. We're not making stupid turnovers. And we're going to play smart elite ball. That to me was what I had been hoping to see for, I don't know, all season.
Larkin, while there were a lot of takeaways on Notre Dame from the semifinals, certainly the more important storyline in that moment was what it meant for Syracuse's legacy, and especially Gary Gate wearing a Gate hat, because it seems like that's what people wanted to talk about on social media. What were your thoughts?
Did anybody make the joke of Hat Gate yet?
You just,
it's right there for the taking, but okay. Sorry, Larkin, I interrupted you.
No, I you know, part of me feels for that senior class. Like, they were burdened with a really challenging revival legacy that ultimately they now have to live with, which they didn't get the job done. Like, Joey Spallina exits, unfortunately, without that at the top as the headline on his collegiate resume. And, you know, he's an elite player. Notre Dame, frankly, is built in a lab to defend Syracuse. We talked all year, every time that either of these teams were mentioned on this podcast, we referenced that with light on Spallina and effectively, you know, non-low fill engage, so erasing him in a phone booth, Syracuse has got to basically play 5v5 above the cage for little subsets of each possession. And they didn't do enough to ensure fluidity and contribution from more than just the Roas and the Finn Thompsons. And like, you need secondary scoring at this level. And you need it, especially in a bad matchup, which is what this is. You know, Syracuse matches up better against other teams. So I feel for them. And listen, they went, I think, 0 for 5 on man up. Can't happen at this level, especially with the players they have. And it's tough. It stings. I'm sure March and Odierna are kicking themselves. And, you know, the truth of it all, because I know at the end of this podcast, we're going to talk about what's happening in Charlottesville. Not at Scott Stadium, but in the other building adjacent. And the expectation at Syracuse is Final Four is national championships. Like, they literally fire John Desko for going to the Final Four, like, every year. So the idea that this is at all a success, or, like, that flowers should be given or anything like that, is insanity. Like, Syracuse is... Syracuse has earned their tradition and their history, and their fan base has really high expectations, and that's just the truth. So it stings. Notre Dame outplayed them, outclassed them, and back to work for Gary and that staff.
I don't share that opinion. I think that the program was in a worse state when this senior class arrived than you're characterizing. And it's not to say, you know, obviously the Tucker Dordovic, Brendan Curry teams, they were undefeated when the season ended in 2020 and had a decent year in 21. But when you overlay the Chase Scanlon of it all with it, there's just a lot of work to be done. I think that it's important to consider that a lot of these guys committed to John Desko, not Gary Gate, and what that means relative to effectively making sure that coaching change didn't cause a setback, right, in terms of losing recruits. As a matter of fact, they, you know, added Finn Thompson and Riley Figueres after that. So in that class, when I wrote Joey Spolino's recruiting issue profile, I really focused on how he was a floor raiser. And I think that's what his career represents. He wasn't a ceiling raiser. And to me, that was a manifestation of his physical limitations. He wasn't going to win by virtue of strength, power, speed, and quickness. He was gonna win by virtue of his intellect, his commitment, his intelligence, his skill. And he did. But ultimately, at the highest level, those have limitations. And they need to be overcome. And the ways in which they need to be overcome are by, you know, superior physical traits, which is what we saw from Yago in the semifinal, or when you overlay it with the Princeton National Championship, just the roundedness of the six-man unit. And we spent a lot of time talking about that. And it wasn't even the six-man unit, because it was really the nine-man unit, because the second midfield provided a lot. And obviously, we've spent a fair amount of time talking about the physicality of the defense and how impressive they were on ground ball play, and all of that rolling up into complementary lacrosse. So I'm not going to say it was a success for Syracuse, but I do think that the floor was re-raised to the level that it is supposed to be at. And there is beauty in that. There is a lot to take pride in that, because they left it better than they found it. In the other semifinal, you know, I don't know how much there is left to talk about Princeton's win over Duke, but I do think that we should all have our antenna up for what this means in terms of the go-forward status for the Blue Devils. I think, you know, ultimately, what they showed in the quarterfinals from the standpoint of the step forward that they're... Well, it was the Richmond game and the quarterfinals from the step forward that their young offensive pieces had taken in terms of being complementary to Ben Johnson and Max Sloat was, you know, their undoing, right? And the things that we hadn't seen in that four-game losing streak reappeared after having seemingly gotten rectified in that three-game winning streak, in addition to which Max Sloat did not have the day that his counterparts had. And so as a result, Duke, we shall see in terms of what's next. Nick,
I just
want
to flag it.
Say goodbye.
I have to go. It's trailer's loaded. Back of the truck is loaded. I love you guys. It's been a fantastic season. Lights just flickered, so I'm a little worried about that. But that's a tomorrow problem. I think a great way for me to sign off after the national championship would be getting an I love you back from Larkin. Larkin, love you, buddy.
Congrats on buying a house, man.
Terry, love you.
Love you more, Nick. That's as close as you're going to get from him, so you should feel good about that.
You know what? I'll take it. Thanks, guys.
You teased it earlier. Obviously, the dramatic story of the week was Lars Tiffany's dismissal from Virginia. A story that, well, first of all, I went into great detail on the Crease Dive podcast with Matt Nessler earlier this week. If you missed it, check that out. I shared a lot of thoughts. But then also advanced on Monday morning with a report that Lars had actually not just received a contract extension last summer. We, I believe, have already talked about that on this podcast, but actually signed it and returned it. And now he and his legal counsel are of the opinion that that means that effectively he's been fired without cause, or alternatively is still the coach of the University of Virginia, depending on how the administration decides to see it with respect to the compensation that he is owed and what that would mean for his financial fortune going forward. Again, kind of retracting back to the big picture standpoint, there's something special about the University of Virginia when it comes to these types of stories. For me, I just chalk it up to the honor code and the Thomas Jefferson of it all. The combination of the level of transparency and, for lack of a better word, drama that seems to follow all these situations. And I'm not joking, because it's not a joking matter in many of the instances of what's gone on at that prestigious institution. But when you isolate it to the end of Dom Starger's tenure and the end of Lars Tiffany's tenure, and you separate out the fact that maybe it's because they both went to Brown that it ends this way, it's just so wild that it's just not clean, right? It's a will there, won't they situation on both fronts. And I think Virginia is pretty committed to having somebody else coach their team, given the fact that they interviewed three or four candidates last Thursday. I don't know whether or not I'm going to report this as a standalone report. So I'm happy to share here, and I can get aggregated if somebody else wants to do it, that Dan Shamati has indeed withdrawn from that process. So he will not be the next coach of the University of Virginia. I've been told a few of the circumstances or reasons around why. I haven't been able to confirm those yet. But yeah, on Virginia looks, I had previously discussed the fact that Kevin Cassis, who is still an employee of the institution, is also represented by John Colon, the agent representing Lars Tiffany. He remains a candidate. I understand that he is well-liked by members of the team, as well as members of the administration. And I think that that is viewed as, a very, I don't want to say safe choice, because it's going to downplay it, but if this is the choice that we make, we will feel good and good about it and comfortable with it relative to a prospective external candidate. And then obviously to, just throw another layer of bizarreness on this. So we've got a program without a head coach hosting the national semifinals and national championship on Scott Stadium, and less than a mile away on Klockner, where the men's lacrosse team plays their home games, they have an alumni celebration at which both Dom Starja and Lars Tiffany speak on Saturday night for more than 100 in attendance, live music, the whole nine yards, as they're raising funds for scholarships. It literally does not get any richer than this. It's like a triple chocolate cake of deliciousness. Larkin, your thoughts?
This is a tough one for me, and I think I'm going to be a little bit more cagey than probably people would want on it. Like, people need to understand this is
real life,
personal. I have a very real relationship with the person who's being gossiped about and the center of this whirlwind, but it comes with my responsibility on this podcast. I get that. I mean, the truth of it from my side and kind of where I want to go is, ultimately, college coaching, especially for non-football, non-basketball, like, you do have a boss. You have a relationship with the boss. And merit and truth and, like, win-lossing is not always the barometer that, drives the bus on some of these outcomes. I was deeply upset by the press release. I think it's an embarrassment. I think she probably regrets that. Lars is a lot of things. Lars is not a bad human being. Like, he is exactly the person that they hired. And what I mean by that is, he has been fairly consistent, good, bad, and ugly, in terms of his style, in terms of his expectation, right? I'll leave it with an anecdote, which is, there are a lot of people who yell and scream. There are very few who run sprints with their players and who leave with their players and who do that at 50 plus years old or whatever it is. And what I mean by that is, a lot of people are going to say a lot of things. The only thing that really matters is Lars lost his job and Virginia's moving on. And, like, I get that it's all good in the sense that there's a lot of good kids in that room, and I hope they pick the right leader for them. And Lars wants that too. Lars probably loves Virginia lacrosse, and well, I shouldn't say probably, he does. And
yeah, you know, he wouldn't have spoken at that event if he didn't.
Yeah, right. Like, you know, it's no different than, you know, sometimes John Tortorella, who's reinvigorated the Golden Knights and may win a cup, like every team he's ever left has been like a, it's been a dumpster fire of media headlines, in the sense of him like running his course. But, you know, when push comes to shove on this issue, I think the one thing I do want to defend quickly is the actual results. Terry just told us that Joey Spallina's legacy deserves to be viewed through the lens of what he inherited. Lars Tiffany inherited something that was winless in the ACC, that had a really good recruit coming in. Sure, okay, give him credit for that. And he won two natties, went to four Final Fours, dealt with a debacle of a pandemic, okay, that has led to a variety of outcomes for coaches in terms of how the administration views their relationship. I can speak to that personally because of the coaching change that we made last year with my friend. So, you know, it's like this is humanity, but the reality of it all is like the results are not that bad. And if you don't want to talk about like leaving it cleaner than you found it, they got a generational player at X. Okay. They're going to be a top five roster. Virginia's a really cool place to go to school. Not a single kid's gotten arrested since that I know of in his decade. Right. And he'll get a job pretty quickly. Like that's the truth of it all. So Carla Williams, live with your decision. Virginia alums are going to rally around the team as they should, by the way, as they should. But when it comes to gossip and all that nonsense, like, you know, there's pros and cons of every coach. But, you know, ultimately, he's a good guy.
I will end, or I want to end with a conversation about Virginia as a host. So obviously I was there this weekend. First time I'd ever been to Scott Stadium. It's really cool. For being as big as it is capacity wise, as a footprint, it feels small. It's nestled right into, you know, dorms on one side, a lot of athletic buildings on at least two other sides. I don't know if I've actually made it all. Well, I guess on the third side is the neighborhood. And on the other side of Stadium Road or Stadium Street, whatever it is. And so very cool in that way. Really nice balance of all the amenities that the NCAA kind of mandates, right, in terms of the hospitality suites, the media, all that. It wasn't like ornate or over the top in the way that the NFL stadiums feel. You know, from a general ticket buyer's standpoint, you know, metal bleachers with seat backs, incredible sight lines. It's just one big bowl. Felt great in terms of the actual vibe within the arena. It was kind of a bummer that we didn't have a dramatic moment late in either or any of the Division I games, because for how intense the Adelphi-Tampa finish was, and when Tampa fans rushed the field, it was one of the wildest lacrosse experiences I've ever seen or will remember, because of how immediate it was. It was like ball hits the back of the net, Ortega's helmet comes off, and we've got like 30 Tampa fans just to be followed by 500 more coming out of the stands. It was wild. But as a result of the lopsided nature of all three D1 games, we never had that. You know, for me, I would say, you know, the ultimate moment was Virginia Maryland at M&T. I believe it was 2011. It was whatever year they had started playing the games later in the day. So it was a semifinal. It was a second semifinal. I take it back. It was not Virginia Maryland. It was Duke Maryland. Was it Duke Virginia? I don't remember. Either way, it was awesome. So that's my number one. But then number two was Penn State Duke in the Garrett Ledman game when Penn State was making a late run. And, you know, they were getting, was it Zombie Nation, I think is what they play after the goals. And they were stringing them together. And I left the press box because it was enclosed. And I wanted to feel the vibe of the stands. And then so I went into the middle of the, you know, kind of in the middle of the Penn State section. And they scored. And it was just like, oh, my God, it was overwhelming. you know, this obviously had a crescendo wave. It was just with 10 minutes to go in the second quarter. And you could really feel the Princeton fans and their energy. But at the same time, like I said, by the time the final whistle blew, a lot of the air had been let out of the balloon. And frankly, a lot of the people had already left. So really cool environment in that way. You know, certainly the location and the cost of the hotels was pointed to as one of the things that, that kept people away. And obviously, if Virginia had advanced and if the weather had been better, we would have seen a bigger number. I want people to remember that this was an event that was supposed to be at Lincoln Financial. And the only reason it was supposed to be at Gillette. But the only reason that it is... No, it was supposed to be in Philly. The reason that it isn't is because of the World Cup. So this was a salvage operation. This was a Band-Aid. This was not a let's optimize this scenario situation. And as a Band-Aid, it was pretty good, right? You know, I think I would characterize it pretty similar to the Joey Spallina legacy, right? It was pretty good. And for me, as someone who has covered these events since 2007, but had never been to one that was held on campus, the last one being at Rutgers in 2002, that was really cool. It was definitely an element that that added something to it. It did give it a little bit more of a collegial vibe. And you know, the bidding cycle for 2029 and beyond is going to open, and I don't think we're going to get the whole scale reconsideration of the schedule that I would wish. I think the sport benefit dramatically from, but I do think that there has been a lot of learning, and I will be interested in which parties want to partake in the bid cycle going forward. So, Larkin, have you ever been there?
I have been there. I went down for a football game when I was a sophomore in college, and I agree. I thought it held up, their side of the bargain. Charlottesville is an amazing town, and I'm sure everyone who was there had a great time. The weather, you know, didn't do its job of maybe making it. I think the crowd numbers realistically would have been up on Saturday in particular, with the concerns around rain. But yeah, I think in terms of like sight lines and quality of the experience, I've heard nothing but positive reviews. And obviously they got the big brands, which always helps. And I actually just wanted to quickly comment on Northwestern, if that's okay.
Yeah, let's hear it.
I thought that... I frankly just think at times that people in our game like dramatically underappreciate what Kelly Amonte Hiller has built. And, you know, think about the credit we gave Bill Tierney for winning at Denver and Kevin Corrigan at Notre Dame in terms of non-traditional hophead, distance from Eastern Seaboard recruiting, force, you know, challenges around travel and fundraising and things of this nature. And like, she's a 9-time national champion, and she just
program had didn't exist. I mean, it had existed, then went away, and she brought it back.
Literally was like recruiting kids off of the running path. That's one of the coolest stories I've ever heard based on like their mile times. And just specifically to the coaching this year, like as you guys know, I'm a little more involved in the women's game now. Like Colorado beats the wheels off them, and you could argue this UNC team and Chloe Humphrey are like some, like maybe a generational team. Like there's a chance she could go down as the best player to ever play this game. And yeah, did Northwestern benefit from hosting? Of course. Students still on campus, incredible atmosphere, right there on the lake.
Did benefit from the officiating?
And I wanted to end on the officiating because Terry knows I've said this before.
You have.
I am so deeply glad that the nation got to see in real time how perplexing, confusing, and damn infuriating it is to watch women's lacrosse and to feel for these players. Like, they are elite athletes. Like, it's impossible to create a bigger headwind and friction to participation and growth than what we deal with at women's lacrosse games. Like, I was so nervous getting off the bus every time I would go in my very informal capacity that I was going to get like thrown out because I couldn't believe the lack of like consistency with the green cards and yellow cards, how confusing it all is. Like, what are they even calling? Why are they reviewing this? You know, like this woman clearly just doesn't like getting yelled at. So she's now like flagging, you know, I respect refs in the sense that, like, I know they have a job to do, and I know it's a thankless job, but my goodness. I mean, just Talk about self-inflicted wounds for the game. So the rules committee just needs to simplify, and helmets need to be considered too, by the way. Because, you know, that outcome is not what you want at that level.
I am really excited for what we're going to learn watching the WL this summer, where hopefully some of that simplification can come into play. But to the point about helmets, I am not a helmet advocate because the women that I talk to aren't, and I just defer to their judgment because I've never played the game. But what I am is terrified every time I watch a women's lacrosse game, because the hold that a mesh pocket can create, even if it's strung to women's stick specifications, allows windups to be too long, such that shot speeds are too high, such that the damage that can be created by a shot ball from a women's lacrosse stick by a woman in a relatively legal capacity just terrifies me. And that's why I've said this before, and I will continue to say it, and I know that it's not a panacea, but I do think that it would be a step in the right direction. Very much in favor of outlawing mesh. And I think that there's some probably dimension specifications that could be changed that would reduce some of the shot speed concerns that I have. But that's just two guys talking about women's lacrosse. That's not our job. That's not our business. But it was a great show on the Lake Show, and congrats to Kelly and Monte Hiller.
I have a follow-up on that, but I don't want to be too long-winded. So if we need to go, we can. I think my feedback would be, what do I actually care about? I want women's sports to grow, and I want the girls to get paid. The sports that do are when the men's product looks identical to the women's product. Women's basketball is exploding. It's really easy for an NBA fan to turn on Caitlin Clark and be like, yep, she's putting that basketball in that hoop. It's the same exact foul rules. Women's tennis, et cetera, the list goes on. I am quite literally a lacrosse junkie. I watch more film than anyone on the planet. I do not know what is happening when the ref raises the flag. Like, I don't know if it's a 3 second. I don't know if it's some sort of crazy green card. It's just so confusing. And the second point quickly on the helmets, of course the girls don't want to wear the helmets. I don't want to make them wear them either. If you surveyed the NHL before they forced them to wear them, they all would have said, I don't want it. And that's why they literally had to grandfather in that people who played back then didn't have to. And that's why currently there's still a few players who don't have to wear visors. It's not about that. It's about, like, safety and, frankly, just, like, simplifying the game's rule structure. I am very aware of the fact that the girls are going to hate wearing the helmets. Like, that has nothing to do with my recommendation. It's so that Chloe Humphrey can shoot off of someone's shoulder, and it's so that, you know, Shea Dolce or whoever can make an elite-level save, and not the only way you see scoring opportunities is through this really bizarre 8-meter structure. It's like, there are elite cover athletes who can guard. Let them guard. Let them approach. Let them guard. Let them break down.
That being said, what a note to end on. How about 8-meter shots in men's lacrosse? That would be sick.
That'd be pretty wild. And by the way, there would be a guy coming off the bench for 8 meters that would absolutely hammer it. Like if you could pick who takes it.
Larkin, we're going to do one more of these, and we're going to do a more of a season-long retrospective, so I'm not going to ask you for any of your season-long thoughts. What a weekend. Thank you, everybody, for listening. Thank you for everybody who came up and was complimentary to the podcast over the weekend. Really appreciate it. Shout out to Drew Sanders, Ryan Sanders' dad, anybody that watched the D3 title game, saw Ryan drop 3-1. One of the wildest stories in all of college lacrosse, a Cal Poly transfer came in from the MCLA and immediately hit the ground running, had the game winner over Salisbury. So it was a pleasure to get to meet the Sanders family earlier today. Larkin, you're jet lagged, man. Yeoman's work out of you. We really appreciate the effort. That's why you get paid the big bucks.
Toughest guy in America. No, I'm just kidding. Great week in Ireland, but all good. Back to work.
Kempin' ain't easy.
Yeah, and thank you to all the veterans and people who served. Incredible Memorial Day. People don't realize, like, you know, I think to end on this note, a lot of what's going on in the world in terms of the political sphere has, like, dramatically overcomplicated a simple fact that there are human beings on those planes and standing on deck on those destroyers, and we are eternally grateful for them. So thank you.
Well said. Thank you for listening to the Tailgate Podcast. If you like what you heard, tell a friend, leave a rating and review, and we'll be back next week with more Tailgate Podcasts.